Good morning and welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, his two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I am your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Together in Faith, LCEF helps to start, sustain, and strengthen LCMS ministries through financial and strategic partnerships. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Tuesday, May 12th, we're studying Psalm 64. In today's text, David prays to God, who shoots his arrows at those whose arrows are aimed at the blameless. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us regular guest, the Reverend Dr. Adam Kuntz. Pastor Kuntz serves at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Oakmont, Pennsylvania. Pastor Kuntz, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Hey, it is great to be back with you. Thanks for having me on.
As we get started today, Pastor, talk to us about the Psalter as a whole, its place in the life of the Christian and in the Scriptures.
Yeah, let me kind of take that from back to front, is that it should have a massive place in the life of every Christian because it is the best way to learn how to pray. I know a lot of people struggle with prayer. They generally just don't think they do it as much as they should. I would say almost every pastor I know would say that too, even if he's, you know, maybe praying a little bit more. Everybody struggles with this. They also struggle to know what to say and how to say it. The Psalter is going to be the place that you can just kind of march through at whatever pace works for you. And it's going to give you amazing words to use for all sorts of situations, even if you're not feeling those, so that when you are feeling those, like the kind of deep, intense, negative things that we're going to see in Psalm 64 today, you have words. The Psalter, for that reason, has always had a giant role inside the church's prayers, not just by way of words, but also by way of structure and the way that different parts of the Psalter flow in and out of the service and in the stuff that comes up for specific Sundays or for specific holy days called propers. Those prayers are going to be aligned with and the selections from the Psalms in things like the introit, the gradual, are going to be aligned with the themes of that day or that season or whatever the case may be, because the church has always known that the Psalter is how we learn to pray and where we learn to pray, I think, at its heart. And to pull it into the Psalter itself, where we are in Psalm 64 is inside Book 2. And I would say that the second book of the Psalter is perhaps the most personal. They are very often things that if you can't say exactly where they are, for instance, the life of David, you could imagine them being somewhere in the life of David. You can also imagine them being used at times of emotional extremity. You're way down. You're extremely disappointed. You feel like you've been cut off from everything, as well as very, very high up emotionally. But I think there are even more of those in Book 5, especially as you end the Psalter in magnificent corporate praise. Book 2 has a lot of the individual psalms of lament, hardship, complaint, different words you can use for similar situations that you can see in the life of David, the author of many of the psalms, but you can also see in the life of any believer.
So with the psalms having this massive place in the life of the church and the life of the individual Christian in terms of shaping our prayers, how does that intersect with the way the psalms teach doctrine, as we might say? Because I think in the modern American Christian mind, the experience of faith, the praying of faith, and the teaching of faith, the doctrine, don't always intersect. But I think the Psalms invite us to keep them very closely interwoven.
Yeah. No, totally. That division you're very right about, but I don't think that diligent Bible readers came up with that idea, whatever denomination they came from, because in the Scriptures, the emotion is always conditioned by who God is and what he has done and what he is doing and what he will do. So there's no way for a believer to separate, quote, doctrine and to leave that kind of locked up in a vault somewhere and then say, okay, I'll go about daily life and I'll just have emotions and be captured by different fancies and you know, difficulties and desires. And then every once in a while I'll study doctrine, which is boring and stupid, and then I'll get back to the really juicy stuff that makes me feel certain ways that I want to feel. In the Psalms, who God is impacts how, to what degree, with what intensity, for how long, and why the believer experiences not only trials in this life, but also a sense of, in just specific to today's psalm, the possibility of vindication, the possibility of being answered by a power higher than any earthly power, the possibility of knowing the truth even if all men around him prove to be deceitful. So those things are all based on doctrine, right? Your hopefulness that might have some emotional content to it, like, because I'm hopeful, I'm more joyful than I was yesterday. That hopefulness is based on the doctrine that though all men be liars, God will prove true. That's a doctrine. That's not an emotion. But my emotion is conditioned by doctrine. So there's no idea that you just get rid of emotion, but that your emotion, as well as everything else about you, all your faculties, all your powers, are conditioned by what you are learning from the scriptures about God. And when you get that from the Psalms, you kind of get that all as a package. That's why they're so powerful for people, because there's not teaching totally separate from a story where maybe I have to make sense of what's going on in the story, like in First Chronicles or something, and then see how that plays into something else. It's all packed up together in the Psalms. So it's very accessible. I mean, Psalms is kind of, once people maybe have read a gospel and they've read Genesis, I then often tell them, you know, let's say they're new to reading the Bible, I will say, go into the Psalms. Yeah. And the reason to do that is because you're getting, it's very nutritious. You know what I mean? There's a lot in there. You don't have to eat a bunch of different things, especially as you're growing rapidly as a new Christian. You can feast on the Psalms.
Another thing that gets packed into the Psalms is music. We have in the superscription a familiar note to the choir masters, how the ESV translates it. How does music play into what you were just saying as well?
Well, the Psalms seem to have, I mean, they are set in poetry, you know, unlike Genesis 1, for example. They're set in poetry, and that tells you that someone is singing them. The exact context for this beyond biblical worship, where we can tell that they're singing both in temple worship, and a lot of this is established by King David, on which, you know, especially First and Second Chronicles is very detailed and eloquent, but also in, you can imagine individuals singing these things. But the superscription for our psalm today indicates that though the voice is individual, as often happens with many of our hymns, the voice is individual, it's a singular, first person singular, some group, some choir is going to be singing this in worship. So even where you're speaking in the first person singular, you can do that together with other believers who have similar experiences. So that the Psalms are, sometimes people will say, oh, they're the hymn book of the Bible. That's not the only reason I don't like that. I'm not saying this just to be contrarian. I would never do that. Pastor Apple knows that.
Never.
I would never do that. But I say this because we don't think of hymn books as seriously as we should think of the Psalms. So equating them is not, you know, hymn books are not inspired by God. You know, some probably come close. I have some favorites. One was published in the same year as Pearl Harbor. But besides that, the Psalms are not optional. It's not like you can leave it aside. Like, oh, I never learned Jesus' priceless treasure. Well, I think you're missing out, but you know, that's very different from not knowing the Psalms, because what you're getting in the Psalms is a full scope given by the Holy Spirit for both individual and corporate worship of the triune God. And so you could just have the Psalms and be okay, but if you left the Psalms out altogether, as maybe many Christians are doing in their individual life, or some churches are doing, not usually Lutheran churches, but some churches are doing in their corporate worship life, I think you are missing out on the way God is teaching his people to speak to him.
Yeah. What about the other part of the superscription, Psalm of David? Again, a familiar phrase within the superscriptions that we have in the Psalms. Yeah. And you mentioned already, we don't have anything more than that in the superscription. Is there right. anything in the Psalm itself that might suggest a particular time in David's life? Does it even matter in this case?
Well, suggest is a nice word, because you know, you can drive an 18-wheeler through Suggest.
That's right.
So I appreciate
have at it.
I appreciate the giant amount of room provided by Suggest. I would say that this sounds like David is writing it. So to say Psalm of David, we're saying both human authorship, but we're also saying that it proceeds from somewhere inside of his life somehow, like Psalm 52's superscription and what happens there. From somewhere inside his life, I mean, David is sometimes betrayed by singular men like Doeg the Edomite in the case of Psalm 52, but I would say here this is more of a king's complaint because it involves the untrustworthiness of a large group of people. And it's hard to see this happening to David before he actually has obtained power, because he has loyal men around him before then. But once you are in power, nobody really likes you. So it's easy to see this kind of a thing happening when, now that he has become king, maybe when he has become king over all of Israel, once that's acknowledged after the death of Ish-bosheth, that he now is surrounded by men who want to talk to him, who kind of want some part of his authority, his approval, his whatever, but they really do, no one really loves him anymore, because the sense that you have is a sense that many people have in different parts of life, you don't have to be royalty, that the people around you are not really here for you, and they may in fact be against you, they just would never tell you that.
You called it a king's complaint, perhaps. Yeah. Does this psalm fit into a particular genre? I know sometimes those are very fluid. There's another, yeah, you know, you can fit a lot of 18-wheelers through things like that, yeah, too.
Yeah, a lot has been made in recent scholarship. The listeners don't have to care about this, but a lot has been made out of this idea of lament. And a key word for such psalms is used in verse 1. That may come into the English as complaint or meditation. Different words are used, but the genre is kind of the same. And the characteristic of the genre is that you are complaining to God about what is going on. Now, along the lines of what we said earlier about doctrine and experience, the point is not what modern people call venting. Like we're like pressurized systems and you just have to vent and then that's fine. And we excuse a lot of bad behavior under the category of venting. I mean, we allow ourselves to say lots of things when we're venting that probably just is really not doing any good for anybody. But what you're going to be able to see over the course of a pretty short psalm, only 10 verses, is that the lament moves towards consideration of who God is and what he will do. And it's not just whining. It's always moving from, here's my experience, here's what's going on the ground, to who is God and what will he do about this?
Good. Let's go ahead and read the psalm then. This is Psalm 64. Hear my voice, O God, in my complaint. Preserve my life from dread of the enemy. Hide me from the secret plots of the wicked, from the throng of evildoers, who whet their tongues like swords, who aim bitter words like arrows, shooting from ambush at the blameless, shooting at him suddenly and without fear. They hold fast to their evil purpose. They talk of laying snares secretly, thinking, who can see them? They search out injustice, saying, we have accomplished a diligent search. For the inward mind and heart of a man are deep. But God shoots his arrow at them. They are wounded suddenly. They are brought to ruin, with their own tongues turned against them. All who see them will wag their heads. Then all mankind fears. They tell what God has brought about and ponder what he has done. Let the righteous one rejoice in the Lord and take refuge in him. Let all the upright in heart exult. That's our text, Psalm 64. Looking at the entirety of that psalm, Pastor, is there a structure that you see within the psalm?
You have a movement from, let's say, desolation in the first verse, certainly, but through a petition that runs from 2 to 4, verses 2 to 4, and then a description of the evil in 5 and 6, and then God's response in 7 and 8, with then consequences both in that future time when God shoots his arrow, which we'll talk about, and right now, verse 10, for those who are hearing these things. So you notice that the psalm doesn't just describe the problem. It also says what God will do about the problem, says what will come out of his resolution, and says, because that's true in the future, because that will happen as a result of his nature as a just God, then right now, let the righteous rejoice and take refuge in him, right? So the one who was desolate at the beginning is among those righteous who, to go all the way back to Psalm 1, are going to flourish in every season because they are planted in God, because they are watered by God's waters. And therefore, even when they are cast down like this, they are not destroyed.
All right, so talk about the first verse, the desolate one, and what he says in verse 1.
Yeah. Notice that this is not about actually having been attacked. Okay, so in modern terms, the person has not been specifically, let's say, victimized in some way. He was not assaulted. He was not, his life was not nearly taken from him. The request is that he be kept from dread of the enemy. And what's interesting about that is you're talking about two secret things. In verse one, you're talking about dread or fear, which is inside of you because of what people want to do to you. Okay, so that's inside of you. No one has to see that. No one, and it's not like David is walking around saying, I'm having a really bad day. You know, that's inside of him. Similarly, inside of the wicked are secret plots, right? So you're talking about two secret injustices or evils. One is fear of one's enemies, not the existence of enemies. That's assumed. There will be enemies, but the fear of the enemy or the dread of the enemy. At the same time, there's a request that what is inside of the wicked would not find its mark. And notice that the way the different nouns that are used to describe the wicked, their plots are just that. They're not plans. God has plans, the plans of his heart. These are plots. And when they group together, they are like a throng, sort of like a teeming mass, a gross, unruly glob of wicked planning. Okay, so they're a throng, and then the parts of their bodies turn into weapons of war. And the significance there is in verse 3, the human body is meant to, you could think of James talking about this, is meant to bless what God has created. But when you make yourself an enemy of another man, then your tongue, which should be an instrument of blessing, instead becomes a sword. And your words, which should be sweet words, that's the Bible opposite of bitter. I don't think we quite think of it that way. But sweet words, like water that's sweet, is drinkable water, biblically speaking. Instead, they aim bitter words like arrows. So the parts of their body of the wicked or of evildoers have become weapons. And you might notice that just as the dread of the enemy is inside, the thing that is inside of them that gives you any inkling of what they're doing are their words, okay? And one thing you could ask yourself with Psalm 64 is David just being what we would call paranoid? Like, everyone's out to get you, David. Okay, yes, you say that every day. You know, everybody's out to get you. Notice that the way to know who they are and what's going on involves the things that they say and the fact that when they say them, they must say them covertly, right? They're, look at verse 4, right? They're shooting from ambush. They also shoot at him suddenly and without fear. Talk about that in a second, but just the fact that they shoot from ambush is an admission that if they did this openly, they wouldn't, or they couldn't, or they dare not get away with it. So when you have, it's not so much that like something a person says is always all that he means or explains everything, or, but it's that the fact that they can only say these things in secret places that shows the wickedness of their intent. Okay. If they were not wicked, they would say these things openly. I'll just give you an example from David's life, right? David is extremely fair and respects God's intention, both with Saul, who obviously and openly hates him, and with Abner, who is the general, as it were, who sort of carries on war for the house of Saul after Saul's death on Mount Gilboa. Abner is the general propping up Ish-bosheth's reign over most of Israel, right? And it's confusing because we tend to call this all the United Monarchy, but it wasn't, right? Israel was always at least potentially at, you know, in a civil war. Abner is like the commanding general of the opposite army. Abner realizes, and you can go look at this in 2 Samuel, but Abner realizes that this is not gonna work well. David is the rightful king of Israel. When he says that to David, David's willing to say, great. And part of it is what Abner publicly says in renouncing the house of Saul, then he publicly announces that he will acknowledge David as Israel's rightful king. It's all public. He's willing to say it. Okay. The wicked are not so because they only do these things secretly. They would not tell you what they're really about, what they're really doing, what they're really saying. And this is not about like David's suspicion. It's about, why are you behaving this way? And you're behaving this way because you dare not openly engage, right? David isn't objecting that they're shooting. He's saying they're shooting from ambush.
So with the matter of the, like, it's in the secret, it's not in the open.
Yeah.
Is there, I mean, something has to be in the open, in the sense that David realizes it in a way that it's more than paranoia, as you said, right?
Yeah.
It's more of a, like a, they're saying one thing, but thinking, intending another, that kind of secrecy, or.
That may be, yeah. I don't want to say that it's secret in, I mean, a lot of secrets are like this, right? They're not actually unknown.
Right.
They're just fairly poorly kept.
Sure.
Right. And so he knows that it's going on. I mean, he's not stupid. You also don't have to be clairvoyant, as you know, the Lord was, where he knows the thoughts of their hearts. I mean, this is like, I know you're plotting something. And that's really easy to see, because anytime that anyone senses between, you know, roughly like 1 Samuel 30 and the end of the historical portions of the Old Testament, that some king is or could be shaky for one reason or another, I mean, they jump right on it, right? I mean, David puts down several rebellions even after his power is established throughout all of Israel. So these are poorly kept secrets that, you know, the Iranians and the Israelis hate each other. Surprise, you know, like everybody knew that, right? So this is the kind of thing that you're dealing with. And yeah, it's not absolutely unknown. It's a set of poorly kept secrets visible in their furtive behavior, right? They're trying to escape being noticed, but that's not entirely possible.
Mm. Yeah, that stands out to me in regards to the imagery that you pointed out in verse 3 of the tongues being sharpened, whetted like swords, the words being aimed like arrows, that the weapons of this psalm are words and secret that maybe will come out, but it starts in the words of the people. That really strikes me throughout this psalm.
Yes. Yeah. It's seen in the words, and you can also see there's sort of a stupid confidence that they have, right? They hold fast to their evil purpose. They're portrayed sort of like, and this goes along with other descriptions of the righteous as birds at other places in the psalms, but in verse 5, they're like men trying to catch birds, or maybe like a fox or something. They're laying snares. And they think that no one will see them. Even saying in verse 6, you know, we looked everywhere. It's fine. You know, we're ironclad. Okay. And that just makes the ending of verse 6 so interesting, because the inward mind and heart of a man are deep, is said right after there are people asserting we've searched everything. And there's a kind of arrogance here about evil, right? That evil assumes control and even proclaims in verse 6 that it has control over things it doesn't even understand. And that is key to the shift that we'll talk about, I'm sure, after the break a little bit more. I mean, I'm sure we have more to say about 1 to 6, but after the break, as the psalm shifts to talking about God, part of the reason you can say, but there's more. This life is not just dominated by the plots of wicked men. Frightening as that may be, right? Because they have not pondered even what the righteous has on his heart or to whom he calls in his need. They don't ponder these things because they think that they have figured everything out and they have control over everything and no one can see them. I mean, it's a blasphemous statement at the end of verse 5. Who can see them? That is the snares they're laying secretly. God? That's the answer. God can see them. God knows what you're doing. God knows what you're saying. God knows what you're thinking. So there's kind of a fearless stupidity about the wicked that they think they can control everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's come back to that arrogance and the fearlessness of the wicked on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor Adam Kuntz this morning. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Who does Lutheran Church Extension Fund serve, you ask? It's simple. We serve Lutheran Church Missouri Synod ministries and church workers with loans and ministry services. And it's faithful Lutherans like you, church members and church workers alike, investing with LCEF that makes it possible for LCEF to serve these ministries. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCEF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCEF investments are not FDIC insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCEF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCEF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Tuesday, May 12th. We are studying Psalm 64 with the Reverend Dr. Adam Kuntz. He serves at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Oakmont, Pennsylvania. Pastor Kuntz, prior to the break, we were talking about the arrogance of the evil, especially on display in verses 5 and 6, as well as at the end of verse 4. You mentioned this phrase. We skipped over it, but we need to come back to it, that the shooting that is done with these arrows of words is done not only from ambush, but it's done suddenly and without fear. Talk about that without fear language.
Yeah, I mean, this would get them a more severe charge in a court of law that they, with malice aforethought, are waiting to kill a man. When you see, it's good that it was translated shooting. That doesn't obviously give us the right technological sense. We're thinking of firearms. They're using bows, but bows are the closest analog they have to a firearm. You might actually remember that this is what gets Saul so close to death that he finishes it himself in the death on Mount Gilboa because he has been assaulted by Philistine archers. So archery is the most fearsome and sudden weapon that they know of. And what they're doing is lying in wait like men sort of hiding behind rocks, if you think of a desert, or maybe a big clump of bushes, and you're going along the road, and all of a sudden, you are shot. I mean, it is a shocking death. And when these men stand up to shoot you, they're not even fearful about what they're doing. They don't even have the decency to be nervous. They're doing it suddenly. They're doing it in their own way, almost calmly. They don't have fear. You have fear. You have dread. You think people are trying to kill you. They have no such fear as they are killing you. So there is lots of different words you could use to describe this. You might say brazen, or we will talk about people having their lives taken, quote, in broad daylight. It's a similar terror that they have brought to each hour of the day by being this uncouth, this brazen, this terrible, to ambush a man suddenly and not even to have any compunction about it.
The phrase without fear, although I don't know that it's specified in this first part of the psalm, and maybe not even the second part either, but in the full context, I think without fear also needs to be without the fear of God, ultimately.
Yeah.
That's what's missing.
Yeah, totally. Right. Because they don't, in verse 5, think anyone is looking. And I mean, this is why when Psalm 14 or Psalm 53 talk about what we would call an atheist, it's always very practical. You say that you don't believe there's a God so that you can do whatever you want. It is to be without fear of God. And that causes you to have a different emotional makeup than a man who fears God and believes that God will hold him accountable for what he's doing.
You mentioned the snares. They think no one can see these.
Yeah.
Again, that idea of without fear, the arrogance. Talk more about that language of the searching of verse 6. It says they're searching for injustice, and they've done it, they think. But at the same time, the heart and mind of a man are deep. Maybe you didn't search as diligently as you thought.
Yeah, right. To search out injustice is a picture of someone doing, you know, we talk in the internet speaks about falling down rabbit holes, which is, you know, please stop saying that because like everyone is saying that. But that's a way that we talk about getting deeply into something. And the wicked here in verse 6 are getting deeply into injustice, deeply into another word you could use would be unrighteousness. And that is usually used in the Bible to talk about unrighteousness between men. It's connected to impiety toward God, to not fearing God, and that results in unrighteousness toward other people. And it's like they have thoroughly explored all the things that you're not supposed to do in Commandments 4 through 10. They have ransacked that library. They have read every page. And so they think that they know how to do all manner of injustice. So you can be creative. There's no need to be graphic about all the different forms of unrighteousness that they have found out. It also shows you that unrighteousness is of a piece. If you are breaking the seventh commandment, you're going to end up breaking the sixth commandment and the ninth and the tenth, I think, obviously, but also the fourth. And because you have already broken faith with a true God in the first table of the law. So now you are searching out unrighteousness in the way with the same diligence that a righteous man searches out the fear of God and righteousness.
So how does the depth of the inward mind and heart of the man fit into that?
Yeah, I think that the evil in their arrogance really just simply do not comprehend, do not grasp the reality of the things of God. So I don't think they could imagine that the righteous man who is persecuted would have resources, would have an advocate, would have a counselor, would have an intercessor in the righteous God. I think they just don't even conceive of that. They figure if they have a lock on the things they can understand, they have understood everything. And that's just a basic confusion many people have, that the things that they understand well are all the things that there are for anyone to understand. So in not knowing God, they don't understand him, of course. They don't call on him, of course. So they really cannot fathom that you do, and that you know him, and that he is eager to defend his people. So that the reason that the psalm transitions, and usually our Bibles lay this out by giving you some kind of line break between verses 6 and 7, but the reason the psalm kind of moves there to a different train of thought is because the depth that is in the heart and the mind of a righteous man is not fathomed by the unrighteous, right? The things of God are not known by unspiritual men. They do not comprehend them.
Like 1 Corinthians 2.
Yeah.
Kind of, I mean, that's as you were talking, I'm thinking of what Paul says there in 1 Corinthians 2 about the like the Spirit of God and discerning the mind of Christ, and we have the mind of Christ, but the natural man does not.
Does not. That's right. Yeah. And so the things of Christ are just unknown. I mean, an example from David's life is people at various times are like, David, why don't you just kill Saul?
Right.
Like, he's trying to kill you. Like, you could go into any court before a jury of your peers. I mean, they don't have that, obviously, but, you know, please humor me in my attachment to common law. You can go into any court before a jury of your peers, and you're going to be like, this guy's been trying to kill me for years. He physically attacked me, so I killed him. And they're going to be like, well, you know, I mean, you know, at least in Texas, right? And so that, and then David's like, well, but no, I would not put forth my hand to touch the Lord's anointed. And the man who does put forth his hand to slay the Lord's anointed, the son of the Amalekite sojourner, David has slain because he says, you did not fear to touch the Lord's anointed. So David's conduct is governed in a way that honestly is not understood even by people who love him. David's conduct is governed by the fear of God. And this is unfathomable to the natural man. Why would you do that? Why would you bind yourself that way? Why would you behave that way? But David is a man after God's own heart, and that doesn't mean that David is sinless. It means that David is attached to the things of God in a way that, you know, endures.
As you noted, the ESV does exactly what you said in terms of the way it lays the text out, putting a little bit of a line space between verses 6 and 7, where now God is the one who shoots the arrow at them, at the wicked. And although the text doesn't say outright that all these secret things that we've been talking about, God is the one who sees them, I think that that God shoots an arrow very much implies that based on what you were saying.
I love it.
As you're saying, well, go ahead. Yeah, you go ahead.
Well, because if you go back to the picture that I had of a man being ambushed on a road.
Yes.
And the bad guys pop up, and I'm just going to use a Western metaphor because, you know, this is an American show. And they pop up, they have their revolvers drawn. And then your good buddy that you thought, oh, you know, and maybe the viewers of the Western TV show were like, oh, he's dead. He pops up behind them and shoots them. You're good, right? But this is also a picture of with the tortuous, you make yourself tortuous, is prayed to God. And what that means is the unrighteous man is caught in the very snare that he was laying for the righteous man. So if you just take verse 4 and you set it next to verse 7, you would see the unrighteous are shooting from ambush at the blameless, shooting at him suddenly and without fear. Verse 7, but God shoots his arrow at them. They are wounded suddenly. Same word. Okay, they're shocked. And then you could put verse 3 next to verse 8 and say, who whet their tongues like swords, who aim bitter words like arrows. Verse 8, they are brought to ruin with their own tongues turned against them. All who see them will wag their heads. So what's happening is that the snare that they laid for other men is the snare that catches them. Luther says this extremely colorfully, you know, as is generally his custom in the Large Catechism, when he talks about the Lord using a rogue to whip a rogue, right?
Yeah.
Is that these judgments of God do not need to be acted out necessarily by direct divine intervention of the earth opening up and swallowing them, like in the rebellion of Korah. They may be, but they may also be very simply that their destruction comes upon them in the way that they had planned for other men to be destroyed.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and with the matter of two things with the Western image, it's like when you on the TV or the movie, you hear the gunshot, but you don't know who's shot.
Yeah,
and then you learn which one has done the shooting.
Yes.
That's kind of the move of verse 7, if you want to picture
that's
it
right.
cinematically. But then the matter of the words getting turned against them, I, again, just to note how we even there, it's still the tongues that are turned against them.
Yes.
It's their words, those things that they thought were secret, that comes back and gets them, and maybe even in a secret way almost. You know, like it continues to be the words that are the weapons, even when it gets turned back upon the wicked.
Yeah, the judgment of God is, I'm not sure what happens to their words, right? It may be that it happens through their words that they are brought to ruin in verse 8, right? But what's interesting about the judgment of God is that it does become public. All who see them will wag their heads.
Sure. Yeah.
And so that differs because God doesn't carry out his judgments in a way that is totally unknown, or that we need to, or that he behaves like a wicked man where we just have no idea what he's going to do.
Yeah.
Okay. Because that's part of the dread of the enemy is, and this is often very effective in, you know, political leaders, I don't know what he's going to do next, right? And that causes people to fear, that causes people to be obedient, that causes people to be on the edge of their seats. God isn't like that. He makes plain what he requires of man. He also makes plain the way of salvation to man. So he's not like this. It only seems sudden to a man who was not meditating on his law day and night. That's the one who's like, I never expected this, right? Or if you think about the rich fool, he is rich in this world's goods, great, fine, but he is not rich toward God. So God's judgment, his own death, the requirement that he now answer for himself is shocking. That's not shocking to the righteous, right? Because it's not as if God holds his counsel back and says, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do next. He tells us what his judgments are. He tells us what the way of salvation is. The suddenness and the way that God's action resembles the action of the evildoers earlier in the psalm is because the evildoer has no fear of God and doesn't think like anything like this could happen to him because of the things that he says and the things that he does and the things that he plans. So there's the suddenness comes upon him and then becomes a byword in verse 8 and verse 9, that the unrighteous becomes this example, and a good simple biblical example would be Sodom and Gomorrah, which gets referred to at various times, or Israel in the exile, obviously also referred to many times in the scriptures. The punishment upon sin becomes a byword so that, and this is kind of glorious in verse 9, so that all mankind fears. So what happens here is that the evils of men are judged by God, overthrown, brought to ruin, and then that can become the means by which other men ponder the fate of evildoers and therefore fear God, which is marvelous, right? He's turning the evil of those men who are judged for their evil to his praise and glory by having men who meditate upon these things fear God. I think that one of the hitches here for modern people is if I don't have, I was going to say have time. That's the way that we say it today, right? I don't have time to fill in the blank. I have time to doom scroll. I don't have time for anything else. Is that if we don't give ourselves time to meditate on things like this, the downfall of mighty nations, mighty kings, the judgments of God worked out in the scriptures, then it really is not going to impact you very much. And you will probably be much more arrogant and ignorant, as the evil are here, than is really necessary, because it's not like we have too few examples to think about of mighty people being brought low, right? Just in the scriptures we have that. And the purpose of having that is not so that we can say, well, at least I'm not like that guy. The purpose is to say he was brought low in the midst of his pursuits.
Yeah. Yeah. To the at least I'm not like that guy.
Yeah.
Jesus has something to say about that when he uses like Sodom, Gomorrah, and others as that byword to say to the people right in front of them, these guys who are the byword would have listened to me. So yeah, that move is taken out. And to the to the what you're saying about the wondrous, you know, examples we have in the scriptures.
Yeah.
This part of the psalm, the public nature of what happens, reminded me of Revelation 18, the song against the fall of Babylon.
Yes.
where you have all the people like, how could this have happened? Like, well, if you'd been paying attention, you would have seen it coming.
Yes, right, exactly. And people don't, because they want to pursue their own ignorant way, and then it will seem to them surprising that God does intervene in the affairs of men, that he does punish men, and certainly throughout the Old Testament and today, nations, for their ungodliness. And in doing so, we are not meant to say, well, at least I'm not like that guy. That's kind of useless. We are meant to instead ourselves repent and fear, which is when you get in, and people love to compare themselves to other people. We only do it, generally speaking, when it makes us feel good, or we think it will. And that is behind the question that is asked of our Lord, you know, in Luke's gospel, what terrible things were done that Pontius Pilate is doing terrible things to our countrymen. And Jesus doesn't answer the question because there is a certain pointlessness to that. I mean, you can ponder why those things are happening, but the purpose of seeing and knowing that terrible things have happened to men in the past is so that you realize that one day your own life will end and you yourself will be accountable to God. And then it really doesn't matter whether those men who died in a certain way that you find objectionable, terrible to think about, were better or worse than you. It doesn't matter, because you're accountable for your own soul. And there are therefore actions in verse 9. The one who fears will tell what God has brought about and ponder what he has done. So there is talking, but there's also pondering, which is to kind of turn something over in your heart, like when you look at something for a long time. Probably for most of us, that's unfortunately just our phone, but I'm talking about like a valuable object. You look at for a long time and you're pondering, you're thinking about it. Where did it come from? How did it come to be this way? Why does it have the shape or the weight or whatever it does? That you do that with the acts of God, because that's actually going to spur, and by fear here, I don't think they mean like just terror,
right,
but the combination of terror and awe and reverence and love, all kind of wrapped up in the attitude of worship that you might think of an Israelite priest having when he enters into the tabernacle, right? That you fear the one whom you're encountering there.
Yeah, and I love how the fearlessness of the wicked in verse 4, now the Lord uses that to bring about the fear of mankind in verse 9.
Yes.
And I think like a good, just to put a story to it, Rahab in the book of Joshua, I think is a good example of what happens, what verse 9 is describing.
Yeah.
That she's heard what the Lord did to the wicked in Egypt.
Yes.
And she's been pondering that, and she is ready to join the people of Israel by the time they arrive at Jericho.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And a lot of people have heard of it. It gets reported at various points in Joshua and maybe even in Judges, but she is one of the ones who takes what God has done and says, I will turn to this mighty God who has done these things to the great nation of Egypt. I will fear him. I will align myself with him and his purposes and his people. So it is meant, the judgment of God is meant to turn men towards him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then I think that flows nicely into verse 10, where now it's specifically the righteous one who is rejoicing and taking refuge in the Lord, and they are also exulting in heart.
Yeah, and this is why, you know, this is why I was whining and I was venting about the concepts of whining and venting, because it's not meant just to say, woe is me, everything's terrible, you know, my knees hurt when I get out of bed in the morning. It's meant to move you from contemplating that these things are true doctrine, to move you to joy, seeking after God, taking refuge in him, and exulting in your heart, because this is true, because you are not sorting out the destinies of your enemies, the Lord is. So you do not have to be controlled by fear, because there is a living God who is your advocate, counselor, intercessor, and friend. And I think that this is a good psalm to bring in if you're reading about heaping burning coals on somebody's head and vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, that you can understand what this means, because I think particularly when we are captivated by the fear of men, not the fear of God, but the fear of men, when that's kind of binding us, that is because we are living as if, or believing as if, or praying as if God is not alive and well. So it's kind of like we believe in God, we just don't think he's going to do anything about this, or he will not intervene. And that is natural to man's fallen heart to think that way. So don't be surprised. And I'm certainly not, you know, putting myself above or beyond any other human being. I'm probably worse, is generally the case with me. But what I mean is, you are exulting and praising because you know he is alive and is on the side of his righteous ones and is firmly against evil. So you do not need to live or pray or feel, as we talk about fear, or feel as if he is not alive and well. Mm-hmm. So you have this kind of this push towards, okay, everybody sing, everybody praise in verse 10, because the truth has been laid out that I'm not actually alone in the midst of enemies, right? There are the enemies, but there's another guy in the canyon who's going to stand up when the enemies stand up, and he will take them out for me.
Well, and I think that brings us back to where you started in the first verse of the psalm, that it was the dread of the enemy in my heart. Yeah. That was the problem. And now by the end of the psalm, it's exaltation in my heart. It's the fear of the Lord in my heart, that the one who is with me is greater than the many who are not. I mean, that's
right.
Again, more than whining, the actual movement of the psalm to that trust and confidence in the midst of my enemies, that I do not need to, well, as we read recently in another psalm, you know, in God I trust, what can man, what can flesh do to me?
Right.
We have the same confidence here. We got about a minute or so left, Pastor Coons. Yeah. Wrap things up with this psalm and especially point us to all this to Jesus from Psalm 64.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Jesus prayed Psalm 64 as was his custom. This also lays out the truth that when you think of Christ, particularly as your great high priest and as King of Kings, you must understand that it means that he is the God spoken of in verse 7. And therefore the one that you know according to his grace by faith is also the one who is an avenger of wrongs and judge of heaven and earth by his Father's appointment. So you can trust in him and exalt in him because he is this righteous God.
Pastor Adam Coons serves at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Oakmont, Pennsylvania. He's been helping us today to study Psalm 64. Pastor Coons, thanks for being our guest today.
Yeah, thank you. My pleasure.
I'm your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about this psalm, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It's always a joy to hear from you. Join us again tomorrow as we continue to look at the Psalms. On Wednesday, we will be looking at Psalm 72. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk to you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.